Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Uber and Airbnb are familiar so-called industry disruptors, the term more often associated with app-based retailers that want to change the culture around business by cutting costs and providing a more custom experience. Today, we're talking about how that applies to dental health and how the traditional industry is pushing back. The product is a mail-order alternative to traditional braces that promises to straighten teeth without expensive orthodontist visits. BuzzFeed News Science reporter Nidhi Subbaraman wrote about the issue. We'll have a link to her article at WOSU.org/allsides. Nidhi Subbaraman joins the show by phone. Welcome.
Hi. How are you?
Good. The company's called Smile Direct Club. Tell us about it.
Right. So Smile Direct Club is a startup that's based in Nashville. It was started by two guys who knew each other kind of in college, who figured that braces were a little bit too cumbersome and perhaps too expensive for adults, and why not have a better option? So they came up with this idea to make a clear aligner that could be affordable for more Americans than before.
How does it work?
Right. So it does away with all the wiring and brackets, and it's a plastic mold that fits over your upper teeth and fits over your lower teeth, and it's designed to gradually push them into alignment. So it takes about 6 to 9 months, depending on where you're starting and where you want to wind up, and the biggest company that does this is called Invisalign, and you usually get it through a dentist. But that's not how Smile Direct works.
All right. So the idea is already out there in traditional dentist office, I guess, or the dentists use it too?
That's right. Yes. Dentists or orthodontists for the past 7 or 8 years now have been prescribing these clear, invisible aligners for people who are perhaps conscious about having kind of metal braces later on in life. And you show up at the dentist's office, they take an imprint, they design it for you, they fit it for you, and you come in for a checkup every 2 or 3 weeks or so, however often they ask you to come in and to make sure things are going on like they're supposed to.
Now, Smile Direct Club doesn't do it exactly that way because it's all self-serve, right?
That's sort of the idea. The premise was to help customers avoid the hassle of going to a dentist every so often, and in doing so, perhaps make it a cheaper alternative that more people would have access to. So the company allows you to they send you an imprint kit in the mail. So this kind of squishy clay-like thing that you stick on a tray and then bite into.
Mm-hmm,
so
right.
they have a kind of cast impression of your teeth, and then you send it back to them. And the company says that dentists in your state will review it, design a mold for your teeth to get you going, and they will just send it to your house. So you don't have to leave, essentially. And you can do this theoretically all virtually.
And the mold changes periodically to continue to adjust your teeth.
That's right. So there's a series of them. So in the first couple of weeks, you'll wear one set, and then there's another set that you have to put on for the next couple of weeks, and then it sort of progressively takes you towards the final goal.
Have you talked to customers who have used the Smile Direct Club?
Yes. They have an extremely devoted and active user base. They're online, in various forums talking to each other, and so I was able to connect with some of them. And a lot of people are extremely thankful that this kind of thing exists. Young professionals just in college or moms with kids and family issues, they said that they perhaps wouldn't have sprung for this if it wasn't as cheap as it was.
Well, compare the prices for us.
Right. So the The price, depending on kind of what the offers are at the time, tends to be around $2,000 to $2,500 for this service,
mm-hmm.
whereas the dentist-issued Invisalign, the other invisible aligners, tend to be around $6,000 typically, although the price sometimes varies depending on, you know, how much treatment you need and where in the country you're ordering them. So that's a couple of thousand dollars for a general case.
Yeah. I mean, the folks at Smile Direct Club said that they're just a middleman between patients and dentists. And I would imagine that the reason why it's so much less expensive is because you don't have the dentist visits.
That's the goal. That's their goal. Yes.
That's what they're saying. The American Association of Orthodontists warns that the online startup service is illegal and poses real risks to customers. Is it illegal?
So that's the thing that's up for debate, Anne. They have the American Association of Orthodontists is extremely concerned that patients or customers of this company aren't going to dentists before they start putting aligners in their mouths that arrive at their doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've contacted state dental boards in 36 states and filed official complaints that describe why this kind of service is illegal for a variety of reasons, depending on state laws. At this time, two states have said they're going to look into this for sure. Another state, Alaska, said they have plans to look into this, but no one has come out and said the company is breaking any laws so far.
What are some of the common reasons that the American Association of Orthodontists cite for why it's illegal?
Some states require that when you have a dental company practicing a dental service, it needs to be owned by a dentist. Some states say that when you have when you're advertising a service like this, you need to say the name of the dentist on your website, which doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of like paraphrasing my understanding of these laws. They're quite intricate and they tend to vary, but that's sort of the gist of it. Some states say that when you have the whole act of taking the imprint and putting the aligner in, that needs to be carried out by a dental professional, which is not how the process works typically in a Smile Direct case.
They said it also, the American Association of Orthodontists said that it also poses real risks to customers. What sort of risks?
So orthodontists and dentists who I've spoken to said that when you try to move teeth without taking x-rays and without kind of knowing where the bone is underneath the teeth, you could move teeth too far, or you could change your bite so that the right teeth don't make contact
mm-hmm.
anymore. So your bite changes and you find it hard to chew food. If you don't go to a dentist before you start this thing, if you have oral health issues like cavities or, you know, any kind of a health problem that needs to be fixed before you make this teeth movement process begin, that's something that might be missed and may become worse as you go through this process. So that's the sort of thing they're concerned about.
Has anybody complained about the service? Besides, I mean, any customer complaints?
Oh, yes, there have been. One woman I spoke to said that the way they fit in her teeth sort of cut her gums, and so she had to go to an orthodontist and start regular treatment because the way her aligners were fitting were basically pushing her gum line back. There are posts online about people having bad experiences with it in terms of, you know, their bites not matching. Or I saw one post about a woman who lost a tooth, but I haven't been able to, you know, I wasn't able to speak to any of those people. But that's sort of the gist of some of the chatter online.
Does Smile Direct Club recommend that people see their dentist before embarking on this kind of adventure?
I believe that is in their contract. That not contract the disclaimer or the terms and conditions that you sign in the fine print somewhere that says go see a dentist and then come to us.
But there's no requirement.
I don't believe so.
How is this
different? They don't check it. That's the better way of putting it. They don't ensure. They don't call your dentist and ask, did you come in before you sign up for it?
Okay. And is this company regulated in any way?
So they sort of are. It's not something that they need approval from the FDA to sell. They do have to give the agency a heads up. The kind of the product does need a check mark from the agency, but they do need to tell the agency, here's how we're operating, this is how our product's going to be used. And so they have that level of regulation.
If someone were to complain and file a complaint against this company, who would they file it with?
Every state has a dental board that oversees licensed dentist practice within a state. And so if you just go to your state website, you should be able to find the state dental regulator, and that would be one place to file a complaint. I believe the AAO would be another option since they have some momentum. Potentially, I imagine the FDA's complaint line would also be an option.
Have people filed complaints or those kind of official type of complaints?
So state dental boards tend to be, almost everyone I contacted wouldn't confirm the existence of complaints. So okay. I'm not sure. I've not heard of any.
Okay. Any lawsuits?
Against the company?
Yeah.
Not at this time.
How long have they been actually operating now?
3 years.
Well, three years.
2014.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is this considered like a telemedicine type of service?
I've heard the word teledentistry thrown around a little
bit. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to the dentists that they say that they are a middleman between patients and dentists, do they ever say who the dentists are that are, reviewing the molds before they're cast?
In theory, the customers are supposed to have the name of the dentist or orthodontist that's overseeing their case printed on the product when it arrives to their house. So in theory, they should know who's looking at their stuff. But if you need to reach them, the company says you basically need to call customer service, and customer service will be the mediator between the customer and the dentist.
Were you able to talk to any of these dentists?
Not for the story. The company wouldn't provide any dentists who worked for them for comment.
But were you able to verify that they are actually our dentists looking at these things?
Yes, I was able to. I know that there are some dentists working for them.
And yes. They're licensed and all that kind of stuff.
I know there are some of them who are licensed.
Okay. All right. all right. Well, Nidhi Subbaraman, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this. Interesting. I suppose we'll have to do a follow-up one of these days, right?
Well, watch the space.
Yep. All right. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Nidhi Subbaraman. She's a BuzzFeed News science reporter. She wrote about a company called Smile Direct. It gives you a service, something like the Invisalign teeth straighteners that you can get at a dentist's office or an orthodontist. The American Association of Orthodontists don't like it. So we'll follow this as it proceeds. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The allure of a fad diet is familiar. Eat this, not that, lose weight. The idea of such a diet has been around for hundreds of years. From Lord Byron's vinegar and water diet to the cabbage soup diet of the 1950s, only what you eat to maintain the diet has changed. Registered dietitian and assistant professor of food science and human nutrition at Colorado State University, Melissa Wadowick, recently wrote about the history of dieting fads for The Conversation. We'll have a link to her article at WOSU.org/allsides. Melissa joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So when did fad dieting begin?
Thousands of years ago, believe it or not. I think people have always been on this pursuit for a quick, easy way to lose weight.
But I didn't realize that weight was an issue thousands of years ago.
It's interesting. I didn't really either until I started digging deeper. I knew that probably in the 1800s, people started to become aware of it. But as early as, like you mentioned, Lord Byron, he became concerned because he couldn't ride his horse, for example. And so he knew that he needed to lose weight. And you'll see references in the literature even to people maybe not being as intelligent if they're quite large.
And what was one of the earliest fad diets to emerge that you know of?
Well, I know that William the Conqueror, I don't know if it was necessarily a fad diet initially, but he started promoting a liquid-based diet. And so after that, other people looked at it and said, oh, well, you know, he drank a lot of alcohol and he was able to live a really long time. And That kind of liquid.
Uh-huh.
More recently, we see liquid diets such as like the Master Cleanse or the Lemonade Diet or even a lot of the smoothies and juices that you see about now. And those are probably more typical nowadays than historically.
You wrote a lot about liquid diets. So when you say William the Conqueror followed a liquid-based diet, it was alcohol?
It was almost all alcohol, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was he drunk a lot?
He drank a lot, and actually people drank more in those days than we realized. That was in the 1000s, and he really felt that he could lose weight and curb his appetite, essentially. He was drinking instead of eating. And I definitely don't recommend that, by the way.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about fad diets. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you could email us at allsides@wosu.org. The cleanse, there is a distinction between a liquid diet and a cleanse, right?
Yes, there is.
What is it?
A cleanse diet typically will include foods that give you a little bit of sustenance and also help you to satisfy your appetite. For example, the lemonade diet traditionally was made with lemon or lime juice and then maple syrup and some cayenne pepper. And that combination really helped to limit people's appetite. And so they were recommended to, or still are sometimes, to drink it 6 times throughout the day instead of eating.
You mean they still do it? That's what a cleanse is?
That's what a cleanse is. People still do it. You'll find probably a dozen different varieties if you look online. Sometimes the cleanse diet will add a protein. Sometimes they'll add an additional stimulant. But for the most part, that's the idea. The idea is that it will replace food.
Yeah, I guess I never realized that it was about repressing appetite or suppressing.
Right. Suppressing appetite is really key because otherwise you're going to be hungry. And there's no magic. I certainly don't want to give your listeners the wrong idea. There's not a magic to the cayenne pepper or that combination that people should try. But it does seem to help them if followers are drinking that, helps them get through the day.
It makes them feel filled up.
Yeah, exactly. Hmm.
And Beyonce made the cleanse popular again in 2006. I didn't know about this, but I don't follow Beyonce very well. What was she doing?
That's what she was doing. Yeah, it was a combination of the lemon or lime juice, the maple syrup water, and cayenne pepper. And she was trying to get ready for a role, and so she was able to lose 20 pounds in 2 weeks. And I would just emphasize that, you know, after that, she did start eating regularly again. It's not something that I would recommend for the long term.
Is that all she consumed, was that liquid?
According to reports, yes. But I've also had clients who've done this.
Is it ever healthy to do that?
It's really not healthy. I think that in the short term, it can be very motivating for people. I think that after 1 or 2 days on a cleansing diet like that, people feel like their belly may be flatter, you know, their head may be clearer, and that's because they're not filling up on the typical junk food, if you will.
Uh-huh.
And so it can be a really good motivator in the short term. And I, you know, even though I don't recommend it, I can go along sometimes with clients who'll do that for 1 or 2 days. And then it's important to, on the following day, introduce small portions of food. You definitely want to use it as a positive transition, not as a way to go back to your old ways.
Yeah, Hollywood and celebrity influence dieting a lot still.
They do.
I mean, back when Lord Byron was doing it, he was kind of a celebrity back then, right?
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Well, we look at these celebrities and we see how perfect their life seems. We only see the glamour. We see them in makeup. We see them with their hair looking wonderful and their body looking slim, maybe even tanned. And we aspire to that. Many people aspire to that. And so they want to know what the secret is. What are the celebrities doing? And if this is what they're doing, this is what the individuals are going to try.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the history of fad dieting. It is not new. It's been around for 1,000 years. My guest is Melissa Wadowick. She's an assistant professor of food science at Colorado State University. She just wrote about this topic for The Conversation. We'll have a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question about fad dieting, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The Last Chance Diet, it was published in 1976. It was essentially a meat smoothie, which sounds horrible anyways, but people died from it. What was that about?
It was horrific. It was essentially a blend of pre-digested animal byproducts, such as horns, tendons, and hides, things that the food processors didn't need, and so they were byproducts. And there was not any regulation at the time. No one was looking at what was in foods, and so it was sold as a meat smoothie. It was sold as a liquid diet, appetite suppressant, and people drank it. And really, it's unclear. There's not a lot of good research into how people died, but it is thought that some of it could have been contaminated, or it could have been just that people relied on it for too long to the extent that they weren't getting other nutrients in their diet.
So did this bring about regulation of diets?
No, I wish it did. I wish I could say that it did. But even now, supplements and diets really are not regulated at all.
So even the canned stuff, those kind of things aren't regulated?
Those are regulated to the extent that the FDA can regulate food if they're marketed as a food.
Okay.
If they're marketed as a supplement, then the FDA does not. There was a law passed in 1994 that says really the responsibility is on the consumer to look at supplements and look at ingredients. The FDA will only regulate it if it's a food.
Do you know what the logic was behind that?
For the FDA or for the consumer?
For the FDA to abstain from a role in that.
They really did it in response to a lot of consumer pushback. Many people said that they didn't want Big Brother messing with their food, and they were afraid, the consumer was afraid that their choices would be limited. And so the FDA followed along with that.
Adam in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Adam.
Hey, I just had a question. I've been doing the ketosis diet now for about 3 months. And with that and exercise, I've managed to drop 50 pounds.
Wow.
It's pretty dramatic. But I've had a lot of people now, including my doctor, say, okay, so when do you plan on stopping the diet? And, you know, how do you plan on transitioning? And honestly, I'm a little bit at a loss for how I should, if it's safe to continue if I were to just gradually increase my carbohydrate intake.
First, tell us, Adam, what is a ketosis diet?
It's sort of tailored for your age, your height, different things like that. But for the most part, it's high levels of healthy fats, moderate levels of protein, and almost no carbohydrates. Very, very, very few carbohydrates.
Okay. Melissa Wadowick?
Yes. Well, first of all, congratulations on your weight loss and your really your efforts to maintain that. I do have some concerns with the ketosis diet, as your doctor and other people have mentioned to you. It's not a good idea to follow it for the long run. I certainly won't say that it's not successful because your evidence that it is successful in the short term. The reason is that when someone eliminates carbohydrates from their diet, their body is first response is going to be to break down fat stores. And so you're going to lose fat because your body needs to be able to give energy to your brain and to your organs. So it breaks down your fat cells for that. Unfortunately, carbohydrates are the only source of fuel for your brain. One of the side effects that I often see with the ketosis diet and that's been documented is people have difficulty with concentrating, with cognitive skills, and with memory. You may or may not have those. Those are those can happen anywhere after a week to up to a year on this kind of a diet. But the other concern for the long term is really the damage that could be done to your kidneys. Because with ketosis, essentially you're producing a byproduct, and your body has to excrete extra of that, primarily nitrogen and ketones, and so it can be a lot of pressure and extra work for the kidneys.
Adam, good luck with that. Thanks for the call. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. If you have a question for my guest, Melissa Wadowick, about fad dieting. Maybe you're doing a fad diet right now and have similar questions to Adam's. 614-292-8513. Can anyone just make up an arbitrary diet without any nutritional evidence and cast it and pitch it as a diet that works?
Absolutely.
That's
the beauty of freedom. Anyone and the downside of freedom. Anyone can come up with a diet, and they may have followed it themselves and been successful, or they may claim to have some scientific background, or none of the above. And so really it's consumer demand that drives the industry, and that's my job really is to try to address the consumer side and help people to see, don't encourage this this capitalistic approach. Don't buy these products, don't buy these books, but instead try a different approach.
Do any of these diets, I mean, as you pointed out, Adam, with the ketosis diet, obviously it's proof that it works, and I put that in quotation marks, but as a nutritionist, what do you think of when you think of a diet working?
When I think of a diet working, I'm really thinking of the long term. And so one of the other things that I would say to Adam about the ketosis diet, and anyone following a similarly very restrictive diet is, I think he alluded to this, should he start eating regular food again? And that's my biggest piece of advice, is that if you're going to go on one of these diets in the short term, you definitely need to gradually add back real whole foods. And have foods that you can do for the long time, the long term. Like have a lifestyle, have a dietary intake that you can eat for the long time, long term. And so when you ask me, is there something that people should be doing? Honestly, instead of going on a fad diet, which you go on and then you go off, it's important to recognize that it's losing weight and keeping it off is more than just energy in and energy out. You know, that old saying, calories in, calories out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so much more than that. There are emotions involved. There's the environment. There are habits. You have a whole history of eating. And many of these diets don't take that into consideration. So a better approach is to, have an honest conversation with yourself. Think about how you can respect your body by putting good foods into it, and then do it, small portions, small amounts.
Tammy in Sycamore, you're on the air. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
I have a question about intermittent fasting. I have been doing that, and it's basically where at least 16 hours a day I don't eat, and then I don't eat continuously for the other 8 hours, but I have two healthy meals and a snack, and I try to make sure that they're always healthy. But there are days, like if I feel like I'm wanting Mexican, I'm going to go have Mexican. If I feel like
Mexican's
Chinese,
healthy.
Well, it can be, but it can be not healthy too.
Yeah, with
it's
the margarita.
The biggest thing that I've read about it.
Yeah. Melissa Wadowick, what about that intermittent fasting?
Hi, Tammy. Thanks for asking about that. That's another popular diet that I've gotten many questions about. And I think that for some people, it can be really helpful for them to know that they have a designated period of time where they're not going to eat. And so that would be the positive side of that. It helps them to avoid snacking and the mindless eating that often happens. On the downside, if someone's not focusing on what their choices are, it can actually lead to poorer nutrition choices. I know that if I go 16 hours without eating, I'm going to eat everything in sight, and I'm going to eat a lot of it. So it does take that that training and that thoughtfulness about what am I going to eat. And then those choices need to be good choices that will keep you full for the long term and give you the energy that you need. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I have found that, you know, it's funny, since I've been doing this, it's kind of like if I start to eat something and it doesn't taste good, I'm like, oh, I am not wasting my meal on that.
Right.
I want, you know, and I'll have like started off with a salad or some deviled eggs, and I'm getting much choosier about what I do eat.
Interesting. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Tammy, for that call. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And, you know, she brings up a good point, like being really thoughtful about what choices she's going to make. And what I tell everyone is that no matter what your choices are, if you can plan ahead and think ahead, that's going to help a lot. And you're not spontaneous, mindlessly eating.
Portion control for me is a good thing. I mean, there's lots of things out there that you can get now that just whether it's a burrito, you know, or something like that is a common thing for me to get. I can control the calories. It's very satisfying. It's healthy because it has the proteins in it and stuff like that. But I know I'm not going to eat too much.
Right. Right. It's funny because I've been a dietitian and nutrition coach for over 20 years. And when I first started doing this, I would tell people, you know, when you go to a restaurant or when you get takeout food, put half aside, you know, only eat half of it. But now I say just eat a third of it because portions that were served are so huge, it's hard to really judge what we should be eating.
It's crazy. I mean, it makes you wonder about, well, the cost of food must be pretty cheap in the United States because the portions are very different. There's the baby food diet that seems to endure. What's the deal with that? Yuck.
It's interesting. I think part of the appeal of that is the portions, as you mentioned. It's controlled. You have a little jar and you can't overeat it. I really think that's the main driving force.
And breatharianism?
Yes, I haven't heard that pronounced, so I don't know. It looks like, for our listeners, it looks like breatharianism, and so essentially it's saying that the air you breathe can sustain you.
Yeah, that's stupid.
It's not wise. Definitely, it's considered prolonged fasting and essentially self-starvation.
Was the cotton ball diet a real thing, or did that just come from Elf?
Oh, no, it's a real thing. The cotton ball diet was popular on the internet for a while, just a few years ago, and it was started, I believe, by models who wanted to satiate their appetite, and so they would eat cotton balls, and it would fill them up, and along with liquid, it would really make their stomach and their intestines feel full. But, of course, the downside was that it would also cause blockage. So, that's what's so interesting, the extremes sometimes people will take.
The cabbage suit diet promised you could lose 10 to 15 pounds. That was in the 1950s. I suppose cabbage soup's not bad for you.
It's not. And there's a lot to be said for soup in general if it's not a cream-based soup. Soup in general is very filling. And so you can eat pretty low in calories and a pretty high volume, and it'll fill you up and keep you from overeating. So the original cabbage soup diet wasn't a bad idea. It was cabbage and vegetables and water with some seasonings. I have seen some varieties or variations of it that included other foods, and it can kind of take on a life of its own. But I think that the downside would be eating the same thing every day, and the plus side would be, you know, maybe starting to eat more soup just because it is filling.
Well, Melissa Wadowick, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time. It's been interesting.
Oh, great. Thank you for having me.
It's Melissa Wadowick. She is a registered dietitian and assistant professor of food science and human nutrition at Colorado State University. We'll have her article about fad diets, the history of fad diets, on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. NBA player Gordon Hayward's opening night for the Boston Celtics in October against the Cleveland Cavaliers was also the end of the season for the star forward. 5 minutes into the first quarter, something went horribly wrong.
Oh, my goodness. Hayward came down so hard. Okay, Hayward broke his leg. Hayward has broken his leg. Hayward has broken his leg. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. And that is how quickly a season can change.
The 6'8 forward had suffered a broken tibia and dislocated ankle, a season-ending injury that is more than physical. We're talking about the psychological road to recovery. Joining us is psychologist and assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee College of Health Sciences, Mona Arvonen Barrow. She co-edited the 2013 book, The Psychology of Sport Injury and Rehabilitation. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
In a Facebook post, Hayward wrote, "At first, it was just grueling to try and watch the team play. I was overwhelmed with frustration knowing that I can't be a part of it right now. I'm not even with the team. It's hard mentally to watch the games because I'm sitting here thinking I'm not going to be able to help the team on the court this year." Is that a typical response in your experience?
Absolutely. I think there are different kinds of responses, and everybody has a sort of a unique response to it, depending on the time of the season when it happens and their own personal circumstances and so forth. But usually it is the concept of I feel frustrated and helpless and I just want to do it for my team is one of the most prominent responses that athletes typically have, because they feel like they're letting everybody else down, not necessarily themselves, but the team as a whole.
Is that true in a way? I mean, how does that differ, compare and contrast with somebody who's an individual athlete, a tennis player, for instance?
Well, I think there is similar responses regardless of the sport. So what we do know from the literature is that most athletes will initially, as soon as they get injured, they will have a cognitive appraisal of the situation. So they will think about, like, okay, what does this mean to me? What does this mean to my sport? What does this mean to my career, my season, and so forth? And it's usually those first appraisals that kind of then lead to subsequent emotional responses. And often it is, it could be a denial, it could be frustration, it could be feeling low, feeling helplessness, and so forth. So those are usually the first responses to the injury as a whole. As the kind of injury evolves and they kind of accept the injury a bit better, regardless of the sport, whether it's a team or individual, then the focus usually shifts. Particularly at the elite level, we know that most athletes view injuries as part of their sport. So it's kind of like the unwanted consequence of taking part at such a high level of performance. And they kind of say, well, they're part of the sport. We're just going to have to live with them and we're going to come back from them. So it's hardly ever the case like, oh, I'm going to give up. It's more of a case of when can I get back? What do I now need to do to get myself back in the game?
Rehab is often a lonely, isolated process. And I thought that's a little bit sounded like what Hayward's going through. He's watching the game, but it sounds like he's watching it alone or something. Does that isolation pose any particular issues?
So I think there's different ways of doing it. And typically in a high level, the rehab situation is not necessarily fully isolated. I think the sports medicine professionals like athletic trainers and physical therapists who work with athletes, they do a great job trying to integrate the athlete into the team environment as much as possible. And by team, I mean things like cross-country runners as well. So they consider themselves a team, same as swimmers. Even though they do individual races, they still are part of a bigger team. So I think they do a lot of things that are like, you know, a lot of the rehab takes place when the other ones are doing strength and conditioning. And so there is some integration. However, it's the fact that you can't do the thing that you love the most, which is to be on the field and play. That's what makes those feelings of isolation. And the way I see it is from the psychological perspective, feeling lonely and feeling isolated is a normal response. Like, it's it's unusual not to have that because you love your sport so much. You want to be doing it. But there comes a point when the isolation, typically, if treated in the right environment, it kind of subsides, and then the fighting spirit kicks in. So the isolation turns into, well, I don't want to be in this scenario, so I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that I can get back in.
That's a healthy response.
Yeah, and that's a healthy response. Having said that, sometimes the athlete snapping out of it, and I'm using that term kind of loosely, is difficult.
Yeah.
So, and when those unhealthy responses, or when, you know, when the sports medicine professional, the AT or the PT or whoever is working closely with the person realizes that everything we do, we're not progressing as we should. So then it's usually to say, well, there is something more deeper here. And maybe at that point, referral to a sports psychologist or a clinical psychologist is a very good call.
Research has shown that injured athletes want their doctors to ask about their emotions and psychological reaction to the injury. And I'm wondering whether doctors are necessarily ready to do that.
I think you raise a really, really good point. The research has shown that both the doctors and the sports medicine professionals, you know, the athletes kind of expect some level of psychological care from these individuals. And I think there is a level to it that they can be helpful. So, for example, I would say that how the theoretical conceptualizations and what the research is saying is that all of these medical professionals, they themselves can influence the psychological well-being really well. So making sure that they listen, making sure that they communicate and they educate the patient about the injury. And I actually think the patient education is the best psychological defense that the surgeon or an orthopedic surgeon or any other medical doctor or athletic trainer can do. Educate them, tell them what's going on. Show them the physical side of the injury. What is your expected outcome? What is your expected recovery time? Because just by educating the patient and educating the athlete well, what you're really doing is you're changing their thoughts. You're changing how they feel about that injury. And you're changing their sort of levels of confidence about, yes, I will get better. I can get better. So I think to your point that whether they're the right people to do that, I think they can, but their limitation really to me goes with the idea that use the education and understand that you, as the person with the most knowledge about the injury, are a key determinant to helping them feeling better about the injury itself.
Can lingering psychological, reactions to the injury affect how quickly, or I guess, could it cause another injury? Can it make you vulnerable to another one?
Yes. So the way we see it is that the injury process is kind of a cyclical process. So often some of those psychosocial issues that may have led to the injury to occur in the first place or may have influenced somebody's susceptibility to become injured are the ones that then get amplified during a rehab. And if the rehabilitation process doesn't go in a way that is a healthy one, and there is some psychological factors such as eating disorders in the background or depression or anxiety, it can prolong the return to play physically and psychologically. And then sometimes if those things aren't addressed appropriately, things like fear of re-injury or re-injury anxiety can put them at higher risk of injury, you know, when they return, upon returning back to their sport.
Does a positive or negative attitude of an injured athlete affect how quickly he or she will recover? Is that what you were talking about earlier?
Yeah. So what we know from literature, looking at all kinds of studies all around the world, is that there are kind of like a three key determinants that both the sports medicine professionals and athletes know that facilitates better recovery is the remain positive attitude, so realistic but positive attitude. You know, you can't be over positive when you have an injury. So mm-hmm. A realistic but positive attitude. Couple that with ability to control stress and anxiety and depression. So all of those maladaptive mood states. And adhering to your rehab. And by adhering, I mean not just doing the required amount, but not doing too much. So ensuring that you kind of let your body that chance to heal, and you're acting in behaviors that facilitate that better recovery. And part of that is what I think what Melissa was talking about as well, is ensuring that you get appropriate nutrition. Often athletes, when they're injured, they may not eat as they're supposed to. So focusing that your body gets the right kind of fuel to heal those tissues and heal those bones, those three things are the key things. So positive attitude and, you know, controlling maladaptive moods and adhering to what your rehab plan is.
Does nutrition change during recovery?
So I'm not an expert on that, obviously,
okay.
But what I do know from the literature is that typically in the early stages of rehab, the athletes may need some more calories, but it should change a little bit during the whole of the rehab. But that's why I'm a big advocate for like an interdisciplinary care plan.
Uh-huh.
So when somebody is injured, it really requires the holistic cooperation from the surgeons, from the athletic trainers, the nutritionist, and the sports psychologist. So we all work together in some cases, strength and conditioning coaches, because they'll be working on areas that the athlete can work on while still being injured.
An email from Brad, he says, having dislocated both of my ankles playing sports, basketball and then volleyball, I can say that I am no longer able to play those sports because of the fear of doing that again. I don't understand how someone like Hayward or Derrick Rose could ever be back at 100%. The psychological part of it is stifling, something that hypnosis is needed to overcome that fear. I still have dreams about dislocating my ankles 25 years later. Yikes.
Yikes, and that's not uncommon to have those, you know, severe emotional responses to injuries. I think, you know, no matter what, how long it takes, it had a significant, you know, emotional response and an impact on that person. So I totally sympathize with him that, but just remember he's not alone. Those things can linger quite far.
Well, I mean, and also I have to say, I don't ice skate anymore since I fell and I ended up getting a frozen shoulder from it. But I am also not getting paid, you know, millions of dollars a year to ice skate. I was crappy at it anyways. Derrick Rose and, you know, Hayward, they have a lot to live for on the court, right?
Yes. And I think this is where the difference between, I mean, we can look at Aaron Rodgers as well, who just broke his collarbone on his right hand. And obviously that's his throwing hand. So it's a significant injury and potentially ended his season in week six as well. But I think that's where the difference is, that many elite athletes, they perceive these as part of their sport. So for them, it's not often a question of, oh my God, I can't get back. It's more of a question, when will I get back?
Mm-hmm.
And we even know from the literature about like transition out of sport due to a career-ending injury, is that it takes them a long while to actually accept the fact that this injury did end their career. You know, most part of the rehab, they enter that with the attitude that I will get better. When will I get to play again? You know, unfortunately, sometimes that's not the case and doesn't happen. But like I said, I think it's the original mindset of like, this is part and parcel what I do. I know I will get injured at some point, but I'm doing everything in my power during when I play and do my performance enhancements that I minimize that risk of or chances of getting injured. And that's how I think a major sports work.
You know, we're just about out of time, but you know, some athletes have injury bugs. They're always hounded by it. Derrick Rose, he's torn his ACL or meniscus a combined four times in a 6-year span. So is that, again, if that's the pro, that's part of the job and they just get over it? Or does that have a different effect?
Well, I do think that they are part of the job. But I think, you know, human beings are psychophysiological social beings. So all of these things, like the balance between rest and recovery, you know, the strength in your muscles, you know, your biomechanics of your movement, your psychological mindset, your focus, it's all of those things combined that kind of can potentially increase your risk of injury or decrease it. Unfortunately, there is no magic formula yet that we would know what is what we would call an injury-prone athlete. That doesn't exist. The science isn't there yet.
Okay.
But I think my key message is that it's an individual and they all have different things that interact with each other in different ways.
Mona Arvin-Imbero, psychologist, assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee College of Health Sciences and co-editor of the 2013 book, The Psychology of Sport Injury and Rehabilitation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's it for Wellness Wednesday. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.